Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the New Books Network. I am Khalid. I am a master's student at the University of Oxford, and today I'm delighted to have with us a very special guest, Professor Francesca Orsini, and we will be talking about her 2023 book, East of Delhi, Multilingual Literary Culture and World Literature, published by Oxford University Press. Professor Orsini is Professor Emerita of Hindi and South Asian Literature at SOAS, University of London. The breadth of her scholarship spans a time period from the early modern era to contemporary times. She has written extensively on the print culture in North India, the Hindi public sphere, on early Hindi literature, on decolonization and the ideology of form, and has of late been working on world literature as well, of which this book is one product. First of all, Professor Orsini, a very warm welcome to you on this podcast.
Thank you very much, Khalid. Delighted to be here.
Professor Orsini, why don't we start this by you telling us something about yourself, your research interests, and how did you come to write this book?
So this is my third monograph, believe it or not, in almost 30 years. So it's not exactly, and it's a work that took me the best part, I think, almost 20 years actually to write. Because it's multilingual, because it covers a long period. I was doing other things at the same time, but it's been a slow burn. I actually come from my first undergraduate degree was in Hindi, and we did a lot of 1950s, 1960s Nai Kahani writers. So after that, I was keen to explore more. And my first book, The Hindi Public Sphere, was really an attempt to do a kind of cultural, social history of Hindi literature in the early 20th century. I worked a lot with magazines and literary associations. And then I discovered that the kind of should Hindi be that a modern, sort of a modern process. Mm-hmm. And so then I was keen to discover what was there before. And as you said, I worked first on the multilingual print culture of the 19th century, commercial print culture with Hindi and Urdu. And then it seemed to me that underlying the Shuddh Hindi and also pure Hindi sanskar is, as we know very well from contemporary India now, right now, but also from the early 20th century, a kind of a view of history and of the Hindu community within it, which saw everything that had to do with Persian, Urdu, you know, Muslims as inevitably foreign and alien. So I thought that if, in fact, instead, North Indian society and literary culture were multilingual and actually people were familiar with several idioms and traditions and so on, but the literary histories were written in very monolingual and monocultural ways, one really had to kind of, in a way, start at the beginning. So from the early, you know, important works in Hindi, interestingly written by Sufi poets, Sufi Muslim poets, to rethink the historical a narrative underpinning Hindi literature, as well as to rethink Hindi literature in ways that were more suited and, you know, fitted more the kind of multilingual society of which literature was part and was a product.
I'm glad you brought up Sufis and the context of Muslims and Hindus and languages being ascribed to these communities on ethno-religious terms, because you begin the book with a very interesting story about the translation of Malik Muhammad Jayasi's Padmavat into French, but that not becoming a part of world literature, even though that happens in, I believe, the 19th century or something. So the concept of world literature is kind of very central to this book. So if you'd like to tell us a bit about what world literature is, and what are your criticisms and your interventions, and what approaches do you have to deal with that?
Yes, so I mean, world literature, there are many, many ideas of world literature and approaches to world literature. So there's, I think, an enduring sense of world literature as being, you know, the best literature of all the world. And that, I think, remains in a kind of common sense idea of what is world literature. But world literature as a kind of discipline has been, or a field, has really resurfaced or redeveloped or been re-energized by people like Pascal Casanova, a French scholar who died unfortunately very young, and David Jamrosch at Harvard, as the kind of comparative literature for the global age. So the idea that, you know, the discipline of comparative literature has very European roots. It's in fact based on this idea of transcending national literatures. So comparative literature is that which is not national. And by saying it's that that goes beyond, in fact, it reinscribes the idea that there are national literatures in individual languages. So Italian literature or German literature or Danish literature. And then the problem became, or for me and people like me who come from different parts of the world, is that when people like Pascal Casanova, David Damrosch, Franco Moretti, who was one of the early theorists, you know, tried to say, okay, now we have to do, now comparative literature has to be world literature. It can't be just literature in European languages. What they did was try to manage it, to say, oh, it can't be the whole of world literature, however. So, you know, to try and immediately say, oh, this is world literature, this is not. So to define it, but also to manage it in models borrowed from the social sciences. So whether it's Immanuel Wallerstein's model of, you know, world system theories with center, peripheries, semi-peripheries, or Pierre Bourdieu's idea of literary field writ large. And the problem is that then a kind of the promise of world literature, which is that to open up and be interested in the whole world, closes down very quickly, because then everything that is not European or in European languages becomes immediately peripheral or semi-peripheral, caught in a kind of catching up and, diffusionist models of the world, or else, you know, that which is written in Vietnamese or Indonesian does not circulate so widely, so it cannot be world literature. So my intervention in this book, which in fact I had great difficulties in placing as a world literature book, you know, I tried non-South Asian series, and I tried to say, although this book deals with not literature, is actually a book about, also a book about world literature, and publishers and editors would say, no, this is a book about, you know, a region, it's not the world, because world literature, people have the sense of, you know, the transnational, global circulation. But in fact, one of my strong arguments in this book is that there isn't one world literature. There isn't one world literary system, but world literature actually looks very different from different locations, and which can be geographical locations, ideological locations, locations of genre, locations of affiliation. So then, it's not that, oh, we need more work before we can arrive at one world literature, but actually I much prefer Debjani Ganguly's definition of world literature, which is world literature is an optics and a ground for conversations. So rather than, okay, certain works or certain authors, of course, appear, no, they've already gained this stature and wide recognition. But actually, world literature allows us, as we do, in fact, in our in the series that we co-edit on Cambridge Studies in world literature can be a conversation between Persian and Arabic poetic modernisms, or another book by Duncan Yoon on, you know, China in African literature. So it's a kind of, it doesn't have to be the whole world. It doesn't have to be even works that everybody knows, because in fact, that would be kind of boring if, you know, world literature were just what we already know. What is there? What's the excitement? What is there to discover? But really more in optics, trying to find different ways of doing world literature. So my gamble in East of Delhi is to say, okay, if most of the approaches to world literature have been this kind of systemic top-down approaches, what does world literature, how is doing world literature, which is to be aware of circulation of different scales or different, the multiplicity of tastes and scales of literature. How does it, what does it mean to do it from a particular location? And from a particular location that is not that of, not a particularly, you know, or one that one would immediately recognize as cosmopolitan. So, you know, if of course, if you talk about, you know, the big courtly centers or the big courts or say port cities or, you know, big hubs, of course, again, you know, world literature in terms of circulation of people, books, becomes more easy to imagine and perhaps to trace. But what does it mean to do world literature from a region that is actually, that doesn't have an imperial center, that is kind of scattered in, you know, small towns and the countryside, over a long period.
Yeah. So the multilingual and located approach that you talk about, that really seems to come out in your choice of centering Purab or Awadh in your study. So would you like to talk a bit about that approach and why did you choose Awadh as the case study?
Yes. So as I said, located, because I think every approach to world literature is located. So, and you know, one of the notions that I use is that, in fact, of the multilingual local, and local is not for me a particular scale, you know, a small town or a city or so on, but it's really this kind of the idea of a location, and multilingual, partly because that's the reality there on the ground. If you take this area, which corresponds to current eastern Uttar Pradesh, and was called, you know, Purab, and the people there were Purbias, or and then becomes known. I mean, Awadh was the name of Ayodhya, no, the sort of medieval name of the city of Ayodhya, and was already a kind of province. And so the area, in Mughal terms, the area that I talk about is really two provinces, two subas of Awadh, so Ayodhya and Allahabad. And so they are my Purab. And there you have Persian, you have what later gets called Awadhi, at the time is just called Hindavi or Bhaka or language. You've got Sanskrit, you've got the Sant mixed language. So you've got, you know, it is a multilingual local. But my contention, and the contention of the project that I led, which was called Multilingual Locals and Significant Geographies at SOAS for 5 years, was that in fact, you know, basically tell me, you know, show me one region of the world that is not multilingual. So multilingualism is not, you know, a particular, you know, unusual or unique feature of either this region or, you know, India as a whole. But, you know, Italy is multilingual. Britain is multilingual, France is multilingual. You know, if you start going beyond the national language and take, for example, you know, Bolis, you know, spoken languages, or the sort of other languages that one has learned and still learns at school, or the languages of minorities, then actually my contention in this book that a located and multilingual approach is useful for discovering, you know, the variety and the life of literature, not just in Purab and in North India, but basically anywhere. So, I hope that people will be inspired. And in fact, of course, there exist studies of, multilingual literary cultures in, I don't know, Eastern Europe, in Latin America, you know. So the idea is that this is in North America, even multilingual American literature. So this is actually quite a, you know, not unusual, but rather common phenomenon. But because literary history is usually studied according to language, this is an approach, an attempt to say, okay, how can we write a literary history that is multilingual, that takes multilingualism as a kind of structure, as Brel Bourdieu would say, of society and of literature.
One way of doing that in the book that you propose is following a genre through history, or writing a literary history of a genre in a way, and you choose the katha genre and kind of show how the katha genre is traveling across languages, scripts, communities, and how writers and poets are intervening very confidently in the local world without these texts reaching distant readers, as you know, someone like David Damrosch expect it to be, to qualify for it to be world literature in the first place. So could you tell us a bit about this, on what does following this through history tell us about world literature?
Yes, so katha is a very generic term for a story, no? Katha, kehna, from and the reason why I use it, you know, is to use an emic term, a term that has actually is used in the text, but also to, as you say, to bring together texts that otherwise would be considered as belonging to different groups or different traditions of different languages, because we are endlessly surprised that people, how can these Persian intellectuals be aware of this Hindi story? Or how can, you know, Brajbhasha writers know about this Persian tale? And actually, I think if instead we think of, and the katha genre, of course, like songs, like most other genres in the early modern period, was what Narayana Rao calls an oral literature genre, so a genre that was copied in text, but also recited or performed. So people would hear it, who would not necessarily know how to read the text in that particular script. And in fact, one of the consequences is that we see text copied in multiple scripts, because the text itself is the same, but depending on the script that the patron of the copy was familiar with, or the copyist was familiar with, we find the same Padmavat written in Persian script, or in Kethi script, or in Nagari script. Now, in modern literary histories, someone like the key Hindi literary scholar and historian Ramchandra Shukla coined the term premakyan, so romance, which is a calque for romance, so a love story, and used it particularly for the Sufi kathas, which call themselves actually prem kathas, you know, love stories. And by doing that in his Hindi Saitik Itihas, Hindi literary history, he actually divided kathas, like, say, Jain kathas, or, you know, Hindu kathas, or take a katha like the Ramcharitmanas, which also calls itself a Ram katha or a Krishna katha, from this Premakyan, which were written by Sufis, which were not completely Indian, as he said. So for me, going actually back to using the term katha that you find in the text is the way instead of showing that, as we can see in Padmavat, somebody like its authors, Malik Muhammad Jaisi, was clearly aware and very familiar with the Ramayana story. So, you know, for him, whether, of course, not Tulsi's story, but and some other form of Ram Katha or Krishna Katha, he wrote himself a Krishna Katha called Tanhavat, were, you know, familiar. He must have heard them around. And then the story and following the story means that you can actually see how different authors for different groups or communities of taste retell the story in their own way. And as I say, inflect it in particular ways. So they can, for example, if you are a Persian writer of a Ramayana story, I mean, how are you going to write about Ram? How are you going to write about Sita? You've got various possibilities. You can make them more human. You can make them more heroic. You can make them less heroic. You can make them more divine, less divine. So I think that this idea of retelling, which of course we have already from A.K. Ramanujans, you know, 300 Ramayanas, you know, it's not a new story in a way, not a new approach, but it's this idea of saying that people will have been, you can see in the text their awareness with a whole range of stories, not just in the language that they write in. And then you can become interested in instead the particular textual and generic features that they remold the story in. So that, for example, in the 19th century, as you know, there's a great PhD, for example, on Urdu Ramayans. Mm. Now, interestingly, you know, 19th century writers of Urdu Ramayans can either have, or maybe both, have the Sanskrit, the Hindi Ramayana, or the Persian Ramayans as their source. And actually you can see how they're kind of bringing together, choosing, selecting what elements, what stylistic elements, what kind of narrative elements, what ideological elements they want to bring in their story. You know, the earliest Hindi Shakuntala is actually, you know, comes from Braj that is aware of the Persian Shakuntala, as well as the Sanskrit one. So, you know, that's following also shows us the reworking, but also the, yeah, the kind of the multi-layered, the multilingual world in which these of which these texts are part, rather than, again, you know, separate traditions, separate language traditions.
Professor Ossini, this awareness about different stories, different traditions in these writers and in these works is exhibited also in the Sant poets who you write about. And you call that process ventriloquism, which is, if I am correct, a way to channel different metaphors and different sorts of stories while giving performances in a way. And Sant poetry is important to you in this book because they are very largely performative and oral. And the oral is usually excluded from world literature because it is not written down. So you also make a case for making world literature oral in a way to extend its conceptual limits. So would you like to talk a bit about that?
Yes. So, I mean, if we think of Sant poets, I mean, I think everybody's familiar with Kabir. Yeah. And maybe Namdev, so the big names. But actually in this book, I focus on the kind of more local ones, like Maluk Das or Paltu Das. And what you find is that they are, what I call ventriloquizing, is that they they show, so as if they are speaking in different voices. So they speak in the voice of, you know, they use women's song, they use seasonal songs, they use swing songs, chulna songs, they use holy songs, they use kind of Sufi, Sufi idioms, they use even kind of quasi-Persian, as I say, you know, so they use, in linguistic terms, they don't use Persian meters, but they use Persian phrases and in a way like you would do Hinglish today. So you would not necessarily use the whole English or use English meters, but you use English words and phrases. So, of course, I don't know exactly why they're doing it. You know, mine is just a speculation, but a certain variety, of course, you find in a lot of poets of this time. Again, think of Tulsidas, you know, he works in different meters and he clearly, you know, enjoys showing that he can do a Ramayana in Kavita form, in Barvai or in, Chopai Doha and so on. But what I find in the sense that in a way that's kind of multiplied. And it seems like my interpretation, at least for Maluk Das or Paltu Das, is partly a kind of communicative one that, you know, I'm going to talk to you about the sort of mystical realities or the practice that is needed or the values that are needed. But I'm going to talk to, you know, I'm going to present them to you in forms, in song forms, poetic forms that you are already familiar with, in metaphors drawn from the every, from professions, from, you know, kind of stories and emotions that you're already familiar with. And I'm going to put my stamp on them, however. So often what you see is that a sun song at the end will have, you know, will have the twist. So this seems to be a whole sort, say, weaving, or a whole song about pining for your absent husband. But in the last line, I'm going to say, but actually, you know, the true one is your beloved and he's always with you, or something like that. Now, what I find interesting from the point of view of world literature, as you say, is that typically world literature, because it comes from this idea of, you know, written text, often printed, wide range in circulation, thinks of circulation only in terms of translation. So, you know, that which circulates is the... So in world literature, because world literature always thinks in terms of texts and printed texts and the circulation of printed texts across languages, in from the point of view of world literature, can only happen through translation. I think that for me, both Katas and Sand poetry are a very good example of the circulation of tastes and of stories and of metaphors, topoi and so on, not necessarily through translation, what I call a kind of poetic traffic without translation, which explains why up to the 19th century, 20th century, even now, and in fact, later Parsi theatre and then film pick up on this, you know, variety and circulation without translation, that even people who are not, you know, formally educated in different languages or different poetic idioms, immediately understand a Sufi idiom, a Sant idiom, a Bhakti idiom, because, you know, they have access through it, through oral, through a lot of it, through songs, in fact. And I think this is not just true of India. Yeah. I'm sure that, you know, if one were to look in, you know, other parts of the world, our literary tastes are not just built on books. That's what I mean, want to say. And I think world literature will to become more, you know, open open to songs, for example, or to access to how do we gain our literary tastes, and how do they become part of our bodies?
So, Professor Orsini, one reason why Sant songs or Sant poetry is so important for world literature is because it also brings to the fore an element of anti-caste sentiment, which is quite prominent in at least some of these poets' works. So, could you talk a bit about that?
Yes, I mean, Sant poetry, so the poetry of devotees, and actually Sant is a really nice term because it comes close to our saint, and so they are poets and saints. They are themselves become object of devotion, or in fact leaders of new communities, and some of them, the most famous one, if you think of Kabir or Guru Nanak, certainly are in a way already part of our literature in terms of their fame, the many times they've been translated, and their kind of a worldwide circulation, you could say. But as you say, Sants are also important for world literature, from my perspective, in other ways. For what I say, they kind of stamp the everyday. So they take any kind of available poetic and song form around, and they kind of twist it at the end. And one of these ways, one of their topics, you could say, or one of their concerns, is in fact the fact that it's devotion, and a pure heart, a heart full of longing, a heart full of bhakti, that is what matters, and not divisions of high and low, or divisions of gender, or in fact divisions of caste. So caste is actually, if one looks, is not necessarily a very large proportion of their songs and of their oeuvre. Even for those who are like Ravidas in North India, born in the lowest caste, but they are important because they talk about it, and they critique caste. They critique the whole idea that, somebody should not be touched, or that somebody is polluting because of the, of their birth and because of the profession they do. But also, I think there's another aspect to it, which is that particularly Sant poetry, and not just because of caste, but certainly also because of that, become a very important themselves be kind of space for critique and for self-definition and self-assertion for a lot of low-caste devotees themselves, men and women, young and old, illiterate a lot of the times. And in fact, as the anecdote of Nirala and Chaturi the cobbler that I quote shows, that they're not just au fait, they don't just understand the message, but Sant poetry and Sant songs become a way acquiring and then being able to transmit very deep knowledge, and also a kind of an aesthetic made of images, of sound play, of a particular construction of songs that you find, and of poems that you find in Sant songs and not in other poetry around them. So it's not just because of their popularity and circulation, but also because they are, important for a very wide community of taste, which again shows that literature is not just about, refinement, but it's about also emotion and refinement in this kind, religious emotion and cultivation of the self and of sensibility and of a sense of community.
Yeah, Professor Orsini, you pointed out in the book somewhere that this cross-fertilization between different poetic idioms is like a really defining feature of Sant poetry. But if we look at what was going on in the kasbas, as you talk in one of the chapters in your book, where you have local patronage networks kind of trying to imitate the imperial, the Mughal sort of patronage networks in bigger imperial cities. But here in kasbas of Awadh, you see that there are literary traditions in Persian or Hindi or Braj Bhasha existing in parallel. So even though Awadh in, let's say, the 16th or the 17th centuries is multilingual, the poets working in these languages are multilingual, but we do not see that kind of cross-fertilization between different traditions. Why is that? Why is that happening?
Yes, for me, the question of, okay, this is a multilingual society, as you say, people are multilingual, spaces are multilingual, then why is it that certain poets mix idioms and languages and some don't? And rather than thinking it in terms of, you know, rather than jumping to a general answer, I have been really thinking, and of course, these are just hypotheses of why one choice or another. Now, in the context of the kind of sophisticated or cultivated, you could say, poet scholars of the kasbas, as you say, whether they are Muslims or Hindu, and who learn Persian and Braj Bhasha, some learn Sanskrit, some learn, you know, Arabic. It seems to me that even when we know, and when they say that they learned and cultivated one of the and enjoyed more than one language and more than one language tradition, the premium was on mastery, on showing their mastery of that of each poetic code. So in a way, mixing was not, you know, was not conducive to their aim. If their aim was to show that, look, I, a Persian educated, you know, Muslim soldier, but also man of the pen from the Kasbah of Bilgram, I can do Persian poetry very well, but I can also do Braj Bhasha poetry completely well, so that I'm recognized as a master. And I'm recognized as a master in a way that modern Hindi scholars say, oh, you don't even see that he's a Muslim. You don't see, you know, he's like any other Braj Bhasha poet. And the same as, in fact, Rajiv Kindra has shown for Chandrabhan Rahman, the same, you know, he wants to show that he's a Persian poet, like all the best Persian poets. He's not mixing any Hindi in it. And it's quite interesting in a way that I think some of the patrons do. Khane Khanan, Abdurrahim Khane Khanan famously does and famously, you know, shows that he can write in different languages. But it seems that the poets, particularly if they become kind of professional poets, courtiers, they will specialize. They will know more than one language often, but they will specialize in one and will not mix. Whereas I think, I mean, and again, this is a hypothesis. If I think of a sant like Maluk Das in the Kasbah of Kara, which is, you know, dotted with Sufi shrines, Sufi establishments, is a Muslim majority kasbah. You know, the fact that he can do women songs, he can do swing songs, spring songs, he can do holy songs, he can also do Sufi type songs. That is in a way, a kind of cultural translation, you could say, or cultural religious translation that Sufis themselves were doing. So you see the mixing and the translating of ideas and of images going on both ways.
And towards the end of that chapter, you kind of caution us against not seeing this. Of course, this is when Urdu kind of replaces Braj Bhasha in a way, at least in how literary historiography about this period is written. It is perceived to have replaced Braj Bhasha in a way in the 18th century. And then there is the other side of this, where we see this, the coexistence of different languages as popularized by the phrase, you know, Ganga, Jamuni, Tehzeeb, like a pre-lapsarian, pre-colonial whole. And you caution us against both these approaches. So how is it that we are to proceed in this case?
Yes, so in the first case, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I think if you talk to anybody and say, what is for you the culture of Awadh, they will only think or immediately think of Urdu, courtesans, you know, the city of Lucknow. And in a way, for me, it's interesting, exactly, not as a sort of wanting to puncture anybody's, you know, narrative, but really it's interesting to see how languages and literary tastes changed even in the pre-colonial period, in the pre-modern period, that Urdu was not popular until 1750 in this region and then became hugely popular, so popular in fact that it kind of erased the memory of the earlier tastes. And that's in a way how things go, rather than, oh, Urdu is, you know, we have to find some kind of continuous ancient line, and with Hindi also we have to find a continuous ancient line. That's, to me, seems not to be the way things have worked. On the other hand, often in literary histories and accounts of this region, already in the early 20th century, particularly when communal or religious tensions, religious riots, sort of wreck Indian cities, North Indian cities in the 1920s, then this idea that sons, for example, somebody like Kabir can embrace and speak in more than one idiom. A Muslim, but who seems to speak in a Hindu idiom, that becomes a proof of social harmony. And for me, that's, again, too much of a simplification. That actually is unhelpful, because as Gramsci, as other, Raymond Williams and other scholars of culture have taught us, I mean, culture is always a domain of conflict, of hierarchy, of struggle, not just of struggle, but so, without, again, wanting to posit some kind of immemorial, ancestral enmity between languages or between people, I don't think one should also posit multilingualism necessarily as as a kind of embracing of an other, rather than, different aspects, different tastes with different aspects of the self that could very well coexist with, caste feelings, with, enmities towards other communities, misogyny, all kinds of social attitudes. In fact, there's a very nice, very interesting character in Rahi Masoom Raza's novel Topi Shukla. His grandmother, so he's a Brahmin, but he comes from a kind of Urdu Persian educated household. And his mother, Raza tells us, she loves Persian poetry and hates Muslims. And I think that's quite important in the sense that, one doesn't have to go, not because you love Persian poetry, you have to have particular ideas about, society or other communities. I think that's quite useful to keep in mind.
And since we were talking about culture, a very important change that comes is the colonial encounter beginning in the 19th century, I think. And that changes at least superficially a lot of things. So can you just tell us briefly about what effects does colonialism have on the multilingual literary culture of Awadh in the 19th century and, let's say, in the 20th century as well?
Yes, so this is the topic of my fifth and last chapter. And basically I take a kind of position against something that I think I also embraced earlier, or a lot of us embraced earlier, this idea of the complete epistemic shift, and in a way, you know, colonialism coming and changing everything and reshaping individuals and society and relationships completely. Now, of course, and what instead I try to posit that, of course, at the level of, you know, the basics, the institutions, you know, the printing press, associations, you know, public education, ideas about language and literature, ideas about society, about progress. I mean, of course, colonialism has a huge impact, and I'm not going to deny that. But I think that we have perhaps, I mean, I think that one of the advantages of coming to colonialism from the periods before it is that we can see the continuities and the kind of rearrangements of tastes instead of, you know, a complete epistemic shift. So, for example, you know, and I think particularly, and we have to, in a way, train our eye a little bit away from, or, you know, to go beyond the innovations, the literary innovations that we always focus on. So the novel, the essay, you know, or, you know, the kind of the modern educated, English educated intellectual, and see kind of modernity just as a Indian modernity, as a kind of translation from English. I think if we train our eye and look at some of, even in fact, of the key people, like Bhartendu Harishchandra in Banaras, if we look even at magazines or if we look at theatre, we see that actually a lot of the older tastes continue. They may coexist now with new tastes and coexist in attention. I find it very useful for the colonial period to look at contradictions, you know, people who say they're going to do one thing and then what they do is something else, or they say they're going to write in this language, but then other, you know, you have Bhartendu, we have to write in modern Hindi, but then all his poetry is in Braj Bhasha. His plays are full of, you know, Urdu and popular songs. He published a lot of popular songs. In fact, his output and that of Wajid Ali Shah, the last king of Awadh, quite overlap in many ways, in their taste for songs, in their taste for theatre. So then, you know, then this kind of neat narrative of replacement, you know, colonial modernity as a replacement, as a complete innovation, as a dichotomization, a kind of separation of Hindus and Muslims and Hindi and Urdu. You know, it's not that it's not true, but it gets complicated by what people did and what people liked. And in a way, theatre, and of course, after it, cinema is a very good place to look. But also magazines, you know, magazines are a wonderful, wonderful platform, because, you know, a lot of new genres coexist with the kind of celebration and the transmission of older tastes and older, you know, older figures.
Yeah. And Professor Orsini, one thing that I was really fascinated by was the kind of the emphasis on education that seems to be there in the cultivation of literary tastes among these multilingual writers and poets and so on, which was there even before the colonial encounter. In the case of Awadh, where you gave the example of a man who was trained in Persian, Braj Bhasha, and all these. So you were expected to be learned in these languages. And then, of course, with the coming of English education, you get access to literatures from Europe in English and French and so on. And another effect that this has is that with the setting up of schools and colleges, you also have the emergence of a lot of publishing companies and houses in places like Allahabad and Lucknow and Kanpur. So how are we to understand the role that education plays in our conceptualization of world literature or multilingual cultures?
Yes, so education, of course, is one of the kind of cornerstones of the imperial mission, isn't it? No, is the idea that, whatever we may be drawing from that society, but we give them education. Now, as scholars of and historians of education in India have pointed out, this kind of grand declarations were matched by actually very little direct investment on the ground. So until after independence, or probably even maybe even later, you know, English schools were very, very few and far between and expensive, you know, just I think a modern, you know, public education, colonial education remain more a kind of model. And of course, the colonial education system set itself up as the, you know, as the awarder of degrees and as the, you know, the inspection. Mm. But actually most of the schools were set up by, you know, local individuals or local groups and so on. And English was not a very great part of education in North India, apart from the, you know, the college education, in fact. Mm. I mean, as we know, that's become, you know, that remained the kind of weakness of education in India well until, you know, after independence, that there was an investment in higher education and less in primary education. Right. So I think universities and college education remained until the 1920s, you know, largely in English or almost completely in English. But my point is that actually very few people could get their degrees, mm. and could even somebody like Premchand really got his degree, you know, many years after he had started working, and he only got it as an adult, no, his BA. Mm. But in fact, if we look at magazines again, I think we can see that Urdu magazines, Hindi magazines, I'm sure other magazines in other languages in other parts of India do a lot of work. I think really magazines are a kind of supplement to education. Education is very limited in practice, but it's magazines that translate from English through English and make modern knowledge, make knowledge about the rest of the world, and as part of it, gradually also knowledge about literatures of the world available, mm-hmm. to North Indian readers. Certainly not, and I think that's what I find quite interesting in a way is the difference that within the education system, English literature remains, you know, the pinnacle. That's the model, mm. the pinnacle. Poetry, prose, fiction writing. And then you start seeing that in the magazines, you start getting French and Russian. And then, particularly in the wonderful, you know, translations of Miraji for Adabiyu Dunya, which is a Lahore publication, even Japanese and Chinese and, you know, Southeast Asian language. So, you know, really the horizon broadens much more widely than Britain or even empire.
Well, that sounds very interesting. But Professor Hussain, if I was just to take you back to a little bit about the making of this book, you seem to have, you know, consulted a lot of material from many different sources, and you seem to also have conducted substantial fieldwork in Uttar Pradesh. How was the experience like? How, as a literary historian, could you tell us maybe anecdotes or your experiences about the process of researching for this book?
Yes, so I mean, I've been going to UP and to Allahabad for the last 38 years. So this book came after, you know, a lot of familiarity, certainly with, with the city of Allahabad, some with Banaras, Lucknow, and the libraries there. But in a way, this book, which takes me back, much further back than my previous books, than my previous research, also involved as you say, more field work in, I can't claim to have gone to, you know, all the kasbahs that I write about, but certainly the journeys to Jaez and the trips to Jaez and to Kara were very very evocative and very very instructive in a way that if, for example, when I went to Jaez with friends, you know, we went there and it looked like there was a street of shops like any other sort of North Indian town, and I thought, okay, how do I find Jaez in here? But then through a friend, actually, one of the friends with me, Sara Rai, she called somebody, a friend of hers in Lucknow, who knew somebody in Jaez who actually ran a petrol pump. And first, you know, he saw this motley group of people there, and he was, you know, he made us sit there and looked at us for quite a while, you know, whether she should take us seriously or not. And then he said, okay, come with me. And then we went beyond, past this street of shops, and we climbed up a hill. And, you know, from the top of the hill, actually, there's just the foundations of what is said to be Jaez's house. But several of the other houses, you know, they have this thin lakori bricks that clearly, you know, are centuries old, with centuries old doors. And also from the top, you could see the remnants of the walls with the various ramparts and the various towers that occur in the description a transposed description of the city, I think, in Jaez's Kanhavat. And also all the sarovar, you know, all the ponds outside. So, and also, for example, from there we went to Ameti nearby, which is really close by, about, I don't know, 20 kilometers or maybe less, where is actually the tomb of Jaez is. And, you know, the stories, and again, you think, oh, this is a story and it's made, you know, it's just trying cleverly to link things together. But there's a story that Jaez used to go to the darbar of the local Raja of Ameti, and he was, you know, he would come and go. And then this local history of Jaez says that he was buried there. And there he was buried there, you know, really close to the site of the palace. So, you know, I think if you go, maybe at first you are struck by the difference or the lack, or, you know, how you can't see what's there in the text. But then, you know, if you're lucky, I suppose, if you if you're patient, if you, you know, try to get this vision and try to find some references, of course, not in terms of direct reflection, but a sense of the that this, you know, there is some correspondence between text and space, which has been really, really important for me. Of course, I didn't visit any, you know, mud and brick fort. They were pulled down by the British when they pacified Awadh. But, you know, you start trusting, I suppose, some of the descriptions in the text more as well. Maybe if I should also just say, this book came out of two projects, but the earlier project, which was really a collective project on how to do multilingual literary history, and people who came part of this project worked on all over kind of North and Central India. But I tried to keep, you know, throughout the 3 years of that project and 5 years of the other project, I tried to keep my focus on texts from this region, from different languages, and particularly texts or genres that either gave a sense of space, so local histories, for example, or descriptive poems, or that were in some way multilingual. So then, you know, little by little, and of course there are huge, you know, it's not a comprehensive history by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, little by little sort of bits came together, and I tried to find links across languages, links between people, find out what they read and what their tastes were and what their education was. And so, you know, yes, the book slowly came together.
Oh, we're so glad that that kind of sustained engagement with the space of our work, we really see that come out evocatively in the book. And so, if I were just to ask you, where do you think world literature as a field of study, if I may, stands today, and how would you like it to develop, or to what context would you like it to become sensitive?
Yes, so I mean, I think it's already changed quite a bit compared to how it was, 10, 15 years ago. I mean, maybe in university courses, you still get taught, as theorists of world literature, the same three people, Moretti, Casanova, and Damrosch. But I think now, in terms of approaches to world literature, I mean, I will mention again the series of Cambridge Studies in World Literature that I co-edit with Debjani Ganguly, and there, and I really like, as I said, her definition of world literature as an optics and as a ground for conversation. So I think what for me, and in this case of my book, of course, it was very much about grounding it, saying world literature cannot be just a systems and global circulation. It has to be located from in a particular, it has to be, has to have layers and complexity, otherwise it's not worth having. Other interesting work that has been done at the moment is between neighborly traditions, so Levi Thompson's book on Persian and Arabic modernism, for example, or on the, again, some kind of non a complex sense of literary temporality. So there's a book, another book coming out in the series by Samuel Hodgkin on Persianate, on Persianate tastes in the kind of Eastern Bloc, so Soviet Union, the communist writers who came with a Persianate a Persianate education and background and sense, literary sensibility, and transformed it. So didn't, jettison it, throw it all away, but transformed it. So then we have many different ways of doing world literature, and I think we who work on parts of different, parts of the world beyond Europe, parts of the world that would seem peripheral, or languages that don't have such a big global footprint. I think we can still find, in fact, interesting ways of looking for connections, looking for particular views, looking for what are the genres that are locally significant, and so on and so forth. I think there's a lot of scope for me, particularly, to think about kind of what you could call South-South connections, or connections that do not go via the, via Europe or via the West. But, and of course the work that historians have done on the Indian Ocean, for example, or on, the Persianate world, or, I mean, I think there's a lot of East Asia. There's a lot of, I think probably. And that's where my term significant geographies comes in. Probably scales and connections that are not, global in a, in a full sense of the world, like everywhere and dominant and so on. They may be actually quite subterranean, or quite, coexist with other trajectories, but there are interesting stories to be told. In one of the special issues that are co-edited, in this case with Laetitia Zecchini, there's a wonderful article by Melanie Bourlet on Pular literature, Pular Wolof, from Eastern Africa, and how, what is location and what is world for Pular literature, where is really the investment that people put in keeping these books, in finding them. They don't really want to, achieve kind of fame by getting the books translated. For them, Pular books are ways of gathering a community, for example, in France or in Russia or in the Middle East, wherever people have gone, have migrated for for work. So, you know, then obviously the world in Pular literature or in Swahili literature is very different from the world in, you know, English or German. Mm. But, you know, I think we are, you know, we are the richer, and if we attend to these different stories, that's a kind of sense, thick sense of the world that I like. Mm.
Well, Professor Orsini, we have already taken up a lot of your time. But if you would like to suggest or recommend any book to our listeners that you really like or that you really look up to, and if you could tell us any projects that you are working on currently, I mean, we got a sense of that, but yeah, if you could.
Yes, so, I mean, in terms of books, I think for world literature, for me, The Cambridge History of World Literature, edited by Devjani Ganguly, is really the, you know, the best that is there out there. And in fact, precisely because it showcases the many different ways that you can do world literature, and why it's actually important for people like us, who otherwise may feel quite alienated by the, you know, global Anglophone, to be part of world literature and to look out and collaborate with others and find interesting projects. Another book that I've really, you know, admired and enjoyed, and I think is very evocative and very original, is Ronit Ritchie's second book. I mean, Islam Translated, of course, was very, has been very influential as well. But her second book, called Banishment and Belonging, on the Malay diaspora in Sri Lanka. Again, it's that kind of, you know, surprising and interestingly layered and complex set of narratives and set of meanings. You know, the idea that Sri Lanka, Ceylon, is important to Malays, but also that it has more than one, there's already more than one word, more than one tradition, more than one, you know, layer to it, already shows how things are, you know, how it pays to pay attention to the layers and the different strands. And really, I think all the books in the Cambridge Studies of World in World Literature so far have been, you know, really, I think, quite path-breaking. You know, there's Duncan Yoon on China in the African literary imagination. As I said, Levi Thompson, Samuel Hodgkin, Juan Cantor on Latin America and South Asia. You know, so this making these connections, drawing these things together, drawing literatures together beyond, you know, the paths that a certain kind of Eurocentric comparatism has sort of pushed us in. And my current project is on magazines. So again, is on magazines and world literature, but trying to bring together the languages I can work with. So Hindi or Hindi Urdu, German and Italian. So I'm starting that project now.
Okay. Well, that sounds very interesting, and we wish you all the best with that. Thank you so much for joining us today for this podcast. And thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for your questions, Khalid, and thank you all for listening.